I've been trained. In giving this talk this evening, it's a little bit funny for me to... I thought it was a little bit funny maybe to start just right in with a talk without some acknowledgement of the event we had this weekend, because it made such a big impact on me, and it kind of still lingers for me. And quite a large number of the Sangha, so about 60 of you all, came Friday evening and Saturday, which is a big number, a big percentage of who we are. Came for this retreat we did on death and dying. And it was, it's a powerful subject in itself, but the retreat was quite interactive with a lot of discussion or little conversations and exercises done together in dyads. And it felt that it was a very strong bringing together of the Sangha, and kind of people getting to know each other, feeling like they knew each other better. And I just feel in general with that one, and also with other things in the last month, I feel that our sense of ourselves as a Sangha, as a more cohesive body who know each other, has shifted. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that, to lay that out there. And since it was really wonderful to do this kind of workshop format rather than a regular retreats in silence, then maybe we should think about doing something like this perhaps once or twice a year of different subjects, because so we can kind of get to know each other better. So what else? Anything else someone wants to say? So I'll start by reading a quote from the Zen master Dogen. And Dogen writes, "Kind speech means that when you see sentient beings, you arouse the mind of compassion and offer words of loving care. It is contrary to cruel and violent speech. In the secular world, there is the custom of asking after someone's health. In Buddhism, there is the phrase, 'Please treasure yourself,' and respectful address to seniors, 'May I ask how you are?' It is kind speech to speak to sentient beings as you would to a baby." Well, we have to interpret that for ourselves. "Praise those with virtue, have compassion for those without it. If kind speech is offered, little by little, virtue will grow. Thus even kind speech which is not ordinarily known or seen comes into being. You should be willing to practice it for this entire present life. Do not give it up. World after world, life after life, practice kind speech. Kind speech is the basis for reconciling rulers and subduing enemies. Those who hear kind speech from you have a delighted expression and a joyful mind. Those who hear of your kind speech will be deeply touched. They will never forget it. You should know that kind speech arises from kind mind, and kind mind from the seed of compassionate mind. You should ponder the fact that kind speech is not just praising the merits of others. It has the power to turn the destiny of the nation." And I like this, that he talks about that even in the secular world there's a custom of asking after someone's health. And in Buddhism, the phrase, "Please treasure yourself," and then asks people, "How are you?" There's a rabbi who gave a talk once, a Dharma talk, though he didn't know it. And it was titled, "Four Phrases to Live By." And he urged the synagogue's members to resolve that in this coming year, you will learn to say four phrases more often than you have in the past. So these seem like very significant phrases. Mm-hmm. And the first one is, "Thank you." The second one is, "I love you." The third is, "How are you?" And the fourth is, "What do you need?" Very simple phrases, but they might have the power to turn a nation, as Dogen says. Because I think the power of them is they express our care and our interest in other people. And often that's one of the most important things we can offer people, is our attention and our care, and not our fancy, you know, opinions and all that. So I bring this up today because I was supposed to talk about this last week. Because last Tuesday, the rumors were that last Tuesday was supposed to be Speak No Evil Day. And we had a guest last week, so he spoke instead and he didn't know. By the way, so next week, almost certainly, Vicki Austin is going to come and give the talk here. And Vicki Austin is a longtime Zen priest, one of the teachers at the Zen Center in San Francisco. And Gary McNabb, who spoke last week, and Vicki, who's speaking next week, and me, who's speaking this week, we were, all three of us were ordained together in 1982 as Zen priests. So we're kind of a Dharma siblings. And so you get all three of us in a row. So May 14th, last Tuesday, was supposed to be Speak No Evil Day. Though I looked in the paper, I brought the Chronicle especially, I went through the whole Chronicle looking to see if, you know, I thought somewhere there had to be some mention of the day. It's a wonderful day. And yes?
Do you want to give some background on
that? I will. And if I don't say enough, then you can fill in. Steve was the one who turned me on to this. I didn't know. What I was told was that this was ordained by the U.S. Congress. You know how they name different days and months of different subjects. Well, last Tuesday was Speak No Evil Day, and I hope they noticed. And the Congress, the Chronicle apparently didn't. But then Steve told me, I mentioned that to Steve, and he said, well, it might not have actually passed. But the bill, there was actually a bill was submitted, and Bill, two congressmen submitted the bill, and they requested that May 14th of this year and next year be Speak No Evil Day. And now there's a beautiful resolution that is in the back appendix of this book. And the inspiration for this day comes from this man named Joseph Telushkin.
He's a rabbi.
Who wrote this marvelous book called Words That Hurt and Words That Heal. And Steve lent me this copy, and I've been reading it. And I think it's a really marvelous book because the subtitle is How to Choose Words Wisely and Well. And I think speech is a really important area for us in our life. And to actually find a book that's kind of devoted in a marvelous way to the subject in a very, I thought, very profoundly and very accessibly is very great. So he was able to convince two congressmen to submit this resolution. And they did. And supposedly last Tuesday was Speak No Evil Day. And I can't imagine the Congress wouldn't have passed that. I think that's a nice... So they couldn't. Well, they try, I'm sure. But since I wasn't able to give a talk last Monday, I felt it was okay, since every day should be Speak No Evil Day. So he writes in his book, Speak No Evil Day will be a 24-hour period of verbal beauty. It will be a day when a young child, frequently teased by his classmates and called by an ugly nickname, can go to school confident no one will say a cruel word to him. It will be a day on which an employee with a sharp-tongued boss can go to work without fearing that he or she will be verbally abused. It will be a day on which that sharp-tongued boss, the type who says, I don't get ulcers, I give them, might come to understand how vicious such a statement is and will say nothing that will cause pain. It will be a day when a fat adolescent will not have to fear a biting comment about his weight from parents and peers. It will be a day when a man who once served a prison sentence, but who had led an exemplary life since being released, will not have to fear that a journalist will publicize his earlier behavior. He gives examples of such things in the book. It will be a day when a congressional candidate who suffered a nervous breakdown will not have to worry that his opponent will use this painful episode to publicly humiliate him. It will be a day when an African American or Hispanic American can be among other Americans without fearing that she will hear prejudicial comments or ugly words about herself or her racial group. It will be a day when a husband who usually only tells his wife his complaints will tell her instead that he loves her and why. It will be a day when people will use the words that heal others' emotional wounds, not those that inflict them. In short, Speak No Evil Day will be a day when, through humankind's collective efforts, we will experience a taste of heaven on earth. So, there's an expression in English that talk is cheap. And maybe we say that because it takes a lot more effort to do action and get something done, physically in the world. But if we look at some of the consequences that our speech can have, perhaps we don't have to. We want to be careful about saying talk is cheap. It's cheap in the sense that words can easily, all too easily, slip out of our mouth that later we regret. But cheap talk is like a cheap Saturday, special, the pistol. It doesn't work very well and creates great damage. And I think there's a lot to be said about being mindful of speech and being mindful of what we say and how we say it and what we're saying. There's a Tibetan saying that says, when you're sitting alone, watch your mind. In public, watch your speech. And I found in my own practice that I was thinking about this last week about practicing with speech and versus practicing kind of on the cushion in my meditation. And I've done a lot of meditation practice. I've done, this is not supposed to be any kind of boasting, but I probably sat myself more than all of you collectively together is my guess. I've gone off to long distance, distant dusty lands and sat, in tremendously long retreats and didn't talk to anyone for 8 months and just sat in this little monastic cell and just meditated away and meditated away. I've sat with tremendous pain, sweating with the pain that I felt. I've sat, for hours and hours and hours without moving. I've experienced tremendous rapture and joy and tremendous sensitivity and intimacy with the mind, just all kinds of things. I think that's all that is easier than practicing right speech, at least for me. And I was wondering why that's the case. Partly, I think, because, at least for me, that when I'm speaking, my mindfulness on myself, what I'm saying, what I'm doing, and everything, is somehow more relaxed. It almost has to be. And so I'm less on my guard. And I'm often, you speak usually in interactions with other people. And when you're in interactions with other people, it's a much more complicated world often in the quiet world of meditation, when you're only watching your own mind and you're only relating to yourself. So those are kind of my ideas. I don't know why exactly, but I find for myself much more, at least these years now, last couple of years, much more challenged with the practice of right speech than the practice of meditation itself. And I hope that challenge is a natural outgrowth from my meditation practice, that as we practice, there's more of an interest and motivation to try to bring our meditation practice, that what we learn in there, the insights, the sense of inner contentment and peace, and to bring it into our daily life actively. And speech is probably one of the greatest places we can do that. Another reason I thought maybe it's more difficult is there's very little support for that practice. And whereas in meditation practice, I've had lots of support. I've had teachers, I've had sanghas, I've had friends, I've had retreat schedules, I had retreats where that was a specific intention was to be on be meditating. But I've never gone on a speech retreat, a right speech retreat. And I don't know of a right speech sangha. Exactly. I don't have right speech teachers who I go to, you know, or talk specifically about this subject. So there isn't that the same kind of support as maybe I've had for meditation. But maybe we need that in our lives, because speech, it's really amazing what he writes in this book. The examples he gives of the effect, the consequences speech can have. I mean, I'm sure all of us have a testimonial about the tremendous pain that we've endured or caused from speech. He makes a Jewish proverb that says something like, that words are like arrows, or wrong speech is like arrows, and not like a sword. Because a sword, if you pull a sword, you can always, before there's damage, you can always put it back in its sheath. But once you release the arrow, you're not going to get it back. And once you release your words, the consequences can be really dramatic. And the people can be pained and hurt for a lifetime. And there are things that people said to me when I was a child that affected, shaped my character, the ways I carried myself in the world, for decades afterwards. And some of them, to some degree, still kind of, I can see that I'm still kind of been influenced by certain things I was told. Almost, you know, what I remember mostly is the negative things that hurt me and humiliated me. But I'm also the legacy of the positive things that were told to me. But there's a funny thing where the positive statements somehow don't seem to penetrate as deeply as negative critical statements. Or you need to say positive things much more often than you need to say negative things. I mean, you might have to tell your spouse or your partner, you know, 100 times you love them. And, you know, it kind of sinks in and deeper, or it makes more sense. But you tell them once that you hate them, and it undoes the 100 times of saying you love them. You know, it's the power of negative speech is so powerful. So one of the stories in here which very strongly moved me was the story of Oliver Sipple, who was an ex-Marine who saved the life of President Gerald Ford in 1975. While Ford was visiting San Francisco, Sipple saw Sarah Jane Moore, who was standing next to him, aim a gun directly at the president. Sipple grabbed Moore's arm and deflected her aim so that the bullet missed the president. Overnight, he became a national hero. When reporters came to interview Sipple, he had only one request: don't publish anything about me. Unfortunately, his plea piqued the journalist's curiosity. Within days, the Los Angeles Times, quickly followed by dozens of other newspapers, trumpeted the news that Sipple was active in gay causes in the San Francisco area. One reporter confronted Sipple's mother in Detroit and asked her what she knew about her son's apparent homosexuality. Mrs. Sipple was visibly stunned, since she had known nothing about it. Of course, that was the reason Sipple had begged reporters not to write about his life. Shortly thereafter, his mother stopped speaking to him. When she died 4 years later, his father informed Sipple that he wouldn't be welcome at her funeral. Devastated by the rupture in his relationship with his family, Sipple began to drink heavily and became increasingly withdrawn from those around him. A few years later, he was found in his apartment, dead at the age of 47. The Los Angeles Times reporter who publicized Sipple's homosexuality made this post-mortem comment: "If I had to do it over again, I wouldn't." You know, so there's these consequences. You know, we don't know the arrow. The thing about the words and arrows is that the arrows are often invisible, and we don't know often where they travel, where they go, and we have to be very careful what we say about other people. Some of the great regrets I have in my life is things that I've said to people, and I wish I could take back. And even apologizing sometimes is the best you can do, but, you know, it doesn't appease my regret. And then the very interesting question I think many of us, probably all of us, could do well in investigating is, why is there such a strong human compulsion to speak about other people's negative traits? or negative deeds. It's almost more compelling for us than their positive qualities or good deeds that they've done. What is it we get from it? Why do we gossip? What is your suggestion? Have you have any of you thought about this, or what occurs to you? Why do we gossip?
I think some people do it as a problem-solving mechanism.
They're working it over. So example.
Speaking about something that bothers you about someone in some way of processing it.
Someone else. That's an interesting idea. That's probably true to some degree. But I don't know if that would qualify as gossip. But maybe. Yes?
Yeah, I think so. I think people, it's an enjoyable thing to do. And Sylvia Boorstein, in her new book, talks about walking with a friend and just walking and not saying anything. And people feel uncomfortable. They can't just be with people. And so to fill that void, I mean, that's the greatest pastime, is to talk about some juicy thing about somebody else.
But the juicy is the word. I mean, juicy means what? It doesn't mean, you know, it can mean positive things for sure. I guess gossip can be neutral or positive or negative. But it seems to be a tendency to that gossip is often putting people down or looking for their bad qualities, is my impression. But, Bill?
I know, I see it within myself and I see it within other people. When I hear people saying bad things about other people, mostly it's because they feel bad about themselves and therefore they're trying to level the human race. Mm-hmm.
So that's one way. Is they're trying to level it, or they're trying to raise themselves, you know, to be above someone. It's also possible. I saw Lelaine said earlier.
There's lots of fun to experience vicariously some wrong or bad thing that someone else is doing that I would never do myself. But it is fun to talk about the other people doing it and having lots of fun at it.
I mean, look who's having an affair.
Yeah.
But you know, really, what that means is, boy, I wish I could.
It's a way of having, you know, set novels.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to bother reading.
Uh-huh. Yes.
It's a way of getting attention, and you know, you're the center of attention while you're telling this juicy story.
Yes.
I think speaking of lottery of humor, I'm very accepting of different kinds, but I've actually stopped watching, you know, Saturday Night Live or Conan O'Brien or Letterman. This kind of thing you're missing in the humor is a really wrong place. It's gone too far.
Yes.
I think it might be a way, too, of not being present for your own life. Because you're spinning tales about someone else's life. So there's something about not wanting to be a fine for myself when I'm doing it. I'm not in my own shoes.
And that might tie into what Lelaine said, is that if you're not intimate with your own life enough, then perhaps there's an attempt to live vicariously. Yes?
Just another way I thought of some of these ideas is it's a way of externalizing an inner conflict, externalizing an inner tension.
Uh-huh. So that's kind of like what the first woman said in the back, is working out some kind of problem solving. So you know, if you're greatly tempted to rob a bank, then perhaps you start talking about other people who are robbing banks to kind of understand the mechanisms and the motivation and all that. So something like that?
Yeah, I mean these inner things are really hard to look at and deal with. It's much easier to see the source of
in someone else.
There.
Yes.
There's a saying in psychology that when there's another, there's fear. And fear brings up that contractedness. And maybe that's part of the, you know, striking out against somebody else with speech.
It's kind of a defense of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yes.
You know, when I was thinking about anger, that
if somebody makes you angry, but you don't feel at ease being direct with them, and you could talk about how weird they are to somebody else, kind of getting off to that. I just, that's something that
he talks about that in this book, and one of the things he says is that he's a strong advocate of limiting your anger to the situation that stimulated it. And what he says often, if people get angry and then they start expressing that anger, working on that anger in other situations in their life. And yes.
And other people as we were growing. And I think this stimulates us to do that same kind of thing, unless we are really mindful to stop ourselves from doing it.
Yes.
Because it does engender a lot of anger and a feeling of lack of self-worth.
Yeah.
This is why I think that you have to hear positive comments so much more often, because we don't have any faith in ourselves.
When I was first interested in girls, like the first kind of girl I got interested in, something like that, I don't know, I don't remember how old I was, but it was kind of like, became kind of, I said something or at the dinner table, or it was kind of known. And the reaction of my family somehow was to kid me or to joke with me. And I was so embarrassed that I didn't bring up the subject of girls at home again for many years. Yeah. Yes?
I think it is a way of keeping distance. I think if you say something kindly, you immediately draw somebody closer to you.
Uh-huh.
And many people are very uncomfortable with closeness. And this kind of joking living at way up in the northern woods of New England, in the country stores, people spoke to each other in a language called joshing, where it was a put-down contest, and people would say very little to each other directly. In families, they probably did, but how they felt like that. And I think it's a way, again, of distancing.
For me, it's when I feel frustrated with somebody, I don't have much control over what's going on out there. It's a way of trying to gain control. And I do it with my kids a lot. And with my wife, I can say I do it quite frequently also.
So you
mainly it's frustration that somehow I don't have control of the situation.
And by putting someone down, can it get... can get a semblance of control again.
Right.
Yes?
I would like to pose a question and make a point, and that is, just, when was the last time you seen somebody with a loss of self-esteem engage in that activity?
All the way in the back. Mark?
I find that, if you say something positive to somebody, the small mind, it's, if you say that person's a really lovely, gentle, compassionate person, it's like, boom, there's nothing more to say. And the small mind wants to keep the conversation going and keeping it juiced up, so if you say that person went out, did something a little gossipy, it tends to support the small mind. I think it's the small mind wanting to continue to run the show. And saying positive things, there's just nothing more to add to it.
Or we don't have the skills yet. We haven't developed the habits of knowing. Maybe learning to speak right. Maybe right speech is like learning a new language. And it's not so much. Maybe it's possible. Just we haven't been trained in that direction. But then that ties into what you said now. Remind me what someone said earlier about we're not comfortable with silence, and maybe we don't need to say something. It was quite powerful this weekend. We did, I guess it was Friday evening, we did this exercise where people paired up and people would breathe together. And nothing was said at all during this exercise. But in the process of breathing together, people felt much closer, probably much closer than they would have been if they had talked for an hour. It was just, you know, 5-minute exercise. Besha.
We've been talking about the kind of negative talk where we know we're saying something not nice.
Uh-huh.
But I feel that the listener has some responsibility too, because I might say something and my heart is clean. I have no intent to hurt someone and they take it as a hurt. I know I asked my mother years ago why she didn't compliment me when now she was saying she always thought I was such a nice little girl. She didn't want me to get a swelled head, so she would say something negative. Out of the goodness of her heart, not that she was a bad person. I took it as hurtful.
So maybe it's some solace to know that it was good intentions behind that. But it's, you know, it could be years of damage. It's part of that legacy also. We have to be very careful. Bonnie.
See, that makes me think of something about the listener, and that is, I've thought it was on both sides, speaking and listening, that if you're gossiping about someone too, or if someone is telling you gossip, how can you be to not engage in that and just stop? I mean, because it kind of tends to go back and forth. And so I've experimented with that some, and it's been sometimes very interesting and uncomfortable.
To stop it.
To try and just to not have a response, because sometimes I feel like someone's trying to engage with you around that, and if you don't, it's as though you're being rude or something, rebuffing or something.
Uh-huh.
In a similar vein, if you have two people who are into practice, like the person who introduced me to all this Pride speech I was with him last week, we went to dinner in Washington, and I was at a conference, and conferences is usually a lot of gossip and stuff like that. And it was really interesting walking with him, because both of us were very conscious. We were celebrating the Speaking of Weevil Day for 3 days last week. And so it was Thursday, but it was really interesting because we had a lot of emotions about what was going on at the conference, but it was like mental judo us the whole time watching our speech and not getting into it. Do you know what so-and-so is doing? You know? It was really challenging.
Yeah. I was concerned with this myself in the last few years and trying to watch my speech more carefully. And what I found that has helped the most is the concept that breath is sacred. And don't try not to waste it, and you certainly try not to abuse it. And if it has that sense of preciousness about it, I found that very helpful.
Yes.
Well, on the other hand, there's satire. And I was thinking about why we enjoy that. If it's literary, it externalizes, it tells you something about the human condition, but it externalizes in a way that's impersonal, so therefore we can appreciate it.
My violin teacher is a person who will not receive anything negative I might say. I come up with lots of opinions that are negative about this, that, or the other thing that I've seen or gossip in musical circles, stuff like that. And she has a way of not responding to the quality of my speech, which is negative, but to just isolate the neutral content out of it.
Huh.
So that is what she responds to. And I've gotten so conscious of speech when I'm with her, because she's coming from a place of right speech, so totally, all the time, and it helps me do that.
I think that you announced that you were going to lead some evenings, Wednesday evenings perhaps, of the precepts?
Maybe in the fall we might do a precepts class.
Happening now, let's go to the precepts.
No, we're doing a refuge class. We're in the middle of it now, and as part of that, we're looking a little bit at the precepts.
I remember thinking. thinking about whether I wanted to go to that and having a lot of difficulty with the part that would be involved with right speech. And I thought, well, that was why I didn't take the precept a couple of years ago, because I had a lot of resistance to that one, and the instructor suggested that I take just that one. Because attention is so important. Uh-huh. And I try to think about it, and I had never heard sort of confirmation the way you provided it this evening about how very, very difficult it is. But for all of these years you have been sitting in silence, that is still easier than to be mindful of how you are when you immediately speak in an unthinking way to someone else. And I think there's something about the process of a dialogue being expected, you know, when it takes its own pace, it sort of pulls me out of being more fully centered. And what comes out is not always what I would have liked to have said.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just on the other end of the spectrum, when I was in the Marine Corps, terms of endearment were a string of four-letter words. And they were, but the heart was there, and it wasn't about the form at all.
Well, I think in some families, you know, there's love is expressed through anger or through angry statements, and so people kind of you learn that you know, if you're in that family, at some point you kind of catch on. And so it can feel kind of nice to know that, you know, that what they're really trying to say is they love you. I don't know. It just seems like it might have unfortunate byproducts. I see in the back. Yeah.
It's a good question. I don't want to beat it to death, but I remember the '50s and the pressure to conform. You know, and not this negative humor or the, you know, like Madonna and Buddha taking top stepping. It reminds me of, you know, that these are people who are different, and there might be some of that pressure to conform. They just think about their culture again. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I'm curious what other people might think in my theory. I do remember the '50s. That's the best that I remember from that time. Well, it's not a good time. The pressure to conform is really bad.
So someone said earlier, it relates with earlier maybe, that sometimes if someone else is doing something you can't do, it might not be that they're doing something. What you want to do might not be immoral. It's just that it doesn't fit into the culture that you're part of. But if someone's stepping outside of that in the way that you'd like to, but you can't because you're holding to the old norms, there could be resentment, or there could be all kinds of funny relationships with that person. That person's threatening to you because they're stepping outside, or your envy, or whatever. And so one response could be verbal attacks. Yes?
Yeah, this is an interesting topic for me. I've read that book. It's, you know, nicely presented. But my son is Polish. Now, in daycare, he and his buddies get together and they're calling each other names all day long. And they think this is just great fun. And it's funny because I know his parents don't model that, and his friends' parents don't model that sort of behavior. We don't model that sort of behavior because they're interests already since 4 years old.
Well, the question is, I wonder where it's modeled from. Because learning to speak that way, I don't know. I don't know enough about children, but I think a lot of it is learned behavior from the models they get somewhere.
Did it went to Beavis and Butthead?
Again? Do
they watch Beavis and Butthead?
No, none of them. Well, see, you don't watch.
It doesn't take. It just takes. You know, the channels.
Yeah, well, one of them has picked it up somewhere.
And then brings it in, and
there's no harm intended with it.
Oh.
And although we do try to make them aware of that, it's really hard to break them out of that. It's a tendency of the boys run through together. The boys and girls run through. It's just the group of boys.
So just. He gives an example in here of just one example, but of a mother who has I think two young daughters, perhaps, and very young, but they're speaking, and she's very upset one day, impatient, and one of them's not doing what she wants, so she yells something at the child, some not very nice thing to get her to shut up. And then a couple of days later, she just said that to the older daughter. The younger daughter was acting out, and the older daughter repeated almost exactly the same expression and tone to the younger daughter. And the mother was horrified. She realized that where her daughter had gotten it from was from herself. So then she realized how important it was to model other ways of communicating. And so I don't know where, you know, they're getting it in child care. Yes?
I once received a fortune cookie message, and I pasted it in the front of my telephone manual, my address book,
uh-huh.
And the statement is, if you speak only well of others, you need never whisper. And I believe when you say the thing about tone, and also about breathing, that whispering and
uh-huh. Yeah, you never have to be embarrassed or secretive or... Yes?
I have two quick 10-year-old stories. My 10-year-old daughter, I listened to her talk to her friends, and there's a sad perception that they have that if a boy likes you, the way the barometer reading for that is, you really mean they really like you a lot. And so we try to work that one through. And the other one is the same daughter. She errs more on the negative side. She's less secure than her other sibling. And she's often saying negative things about other people. My husband and I were away 2 weeks ago for 10 days. And we came home and there was just a litany of complaints about the babysitter and this one and that one. And I find what really helps with her is to get underneath that negativity and ask what else is going on. And I just said, were things really that bad? Was she really like that? Or did you just miss her? And she just broke into tears. Everything melted away and she said, I just missed her.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
In these conversations made me think about cultural differences in verbal styles. For example, in the Black community, you have this playing the dozens where people who try to outwit each other with the kind of repartee that in certain groups. And the Japanese cover up all their hostility and politenesses very often. I don't know if these things are generalizations or whether they're particular segments of the community, but there really are cultural differences in both.
So we have to be sensitive to the great word these days is diversity. But what Buddhism offers as you all know, is focused on intention. And what is the intention behind your acts and what you're going to do? And if the intention is to inflict harm, I don't think it's ever even, at least from a spiritual life, it's not appropriate. So is there intention to inflict harm on someone or to create harm or to speak harmfully? Or does it come out of anger, out of aggression, out of one-upmanship, out of a need for status? Does it come out of fear or insecurity to fill up time? Or does it come from a desire to bond with someone because, you know, we really want to bond with people. And one way to bond is to have juicy conversations. So you have juicy conversations about the third party. And then you're really together. But in the process, you also, I think that kind of conversation also alienates. Maybe it doesn't alienate you immediately with the person that you're sharing the juice with, but there's an alienation then with the third party. And I think that kind of language then, not only does it, I think it just fosters more, it alienates itself and it kind of supports increased alienation. And one of the things I believe that from a Buddhist spiritual life, the criteria or the interest that we have is what kind of speech can we use that doesn't alienate people, but rather brings together people together, creates non-separation, creates connectedness. And I think I've talked before about the four criteria the Buddha gave for what is right speech. And I think it's a beautiful little kind of very short, succinct kind of criteria to kind of measure your speech by. One is it true, what you're going to say? You should at least know that and understand whether it's true or not. And is it kind, what you're going to say? And kind doesn't necessarily mean that it's sugary. And is it useful to say it? And useful means also, if the person's not going to hear your criticism. Sometimes it's appropriate to criticize. If they're not going to hear it, then don't bother, the Buddha said. And the fourth is it conducive towards harmony? Does it promote harmony among people, connectedness? And I suspect that a lot of the pain that out of which people act out negatively, both verbally and violently in our society, comes from being alienated in some way from themselves and from others. And it's kind of misplaced kind of ways of compensating for that, that we are so critical or so violent. There was I shouldn't use a book review as a quote, but there was in a paper this Sunday, there was a book on violence by a man who spent years working with it, James Gilligan, a psychiatrist. And he writes, "I am convinced that violent behavior, even at its most apparent senseless, incomprehensible, and psychotic, is an understandable response to an identifiable specific set of conditions. I've yet to see a serious act of violence that was not provoked by feeling of being shamed or humiliated, disrespected or ridiculed, and that did not represent the attempt to prevent or undo this loss of face, no matter how severe the punishment, even if it includes death." So I thought that was a very interesting statement. And most of those things, being shamed and humiliated, disrespected, and the other word, ridiculed. Happens very much through speech and what we say to each other. It can be very, very powerful. And the small things we say to a child verbally can be acted out physically as an adult or later in life. And what I believe that a spiritual life, an exploration of life that arises from a meditation practice, what it offers is two things. One is it offers us a chance to be settled on ourselves, to find some inner contentment, a content with ourselves, to be at peace, and to be kind of whole without being propped up by all kinds of needs around us, without needing to have people prop us up, needing to have an identity that gets boosted by certain kinds of conversations. To find some kind of inner contentment through your sitting, and then come from that into our life. To bring a Buddhist spiritual life is a life that arises in part from that contentment, or from that hope. From that place, enter into the world. And then the other thing that a Buddhist practice brings is not only kind of settledness or calmness or contentness, but it also brings the practice of insight, of actually noticing what the dynamics are going on in the present moment. So we can actually see, when we speak out of fear, when we speak out of resentment, or we speak out of the desire to praise ourselves at the expense of others, to see all the little movements in the mind, to get familiar with them in meditation, so maybe we can catch them earlier and earlier as we go about our life. And I know both those things have helped me a lot. Even though I find it very difficult to work with speech, I feel that there's kind of a natural kind of flowing over into speech of the practice that I've done on the cushion, the mindfulness practice that I have, that just naturally, even without trying to practice with speech, I think care in speaking kind of flows over into the rest of our life just from this practice. But even more so if we take speech as something that we actually want to engage ourselves in as a practice. Not to oppress ourselves, but really to let something else flower. I believe that part of the reason I think it is kind of like learning a different language. And for whatever reason, and we all mentioned many of them today, I think many of us have a tendency to focus or find or search out the negative in a situation, negative things and qualities in other people, much more than the positive. But perhaps as we feel more comfortable in ourselves and identify the positive, beautiful qualities in ourselves more clearly, we can start appreciating the value of those in other people and see that actually there's more value, more delight, more satisfaction in a sense to water or fertilize the beautiful qualities in other people than it is to indirectly or whatever, unconsciously perhaps even, unintentionally perhaps, through negative and harmful speech to actually repress those beautiful qualities and actually encourage the negative qualities to be more and more of our life. So I hope that was a positive enough note to end on, because I was concerned, I wanted to have a really positive up way of ending, and I had a story to read. But now we're late. So I'll just tell you I had a great story and to tell you, and someday I'll tell you, and you can just go home uplifted. Thank you all.